It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about Genghis Khan's rise to power in Mongolia and beyond into the 12th century and what it had to do with climate change. We'll check out the world of science with Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlak.
First, it happened. Scott Walker is now running for president. Yesterday, he signed the $72.7 billion state budget into law. And early this morning, he announced his candidacy for president with a tweet that said, "I'm in. I'm running for president because Americans deserve a leader who will fight and win for them." Here's a clip from the video he released about his presidential bid.
America needs new, fresh leadership with big, bold ideas from outside of Washington to actually get things done. In Wisconsin, we didn't nibble around the edges. We enacted big, bold reforms, took power out of the hands of the big government special interests, gave it to the hardworking taxpayers.
Governor Walker's formal campaign kickoff is scheduled for 5 today in Waukesha. Sean Johnson is with us now. He's the state government reporter for WPR News. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
So were you surprised that Governor Walker pre-announced this morning that he's running for president with a tweet and the video release before the event this afternoon?
Yeah, I definitely did a double take there, just given that it was a few days ago his campaign sent out a tweet by mistake that said that he had announced for president or that he was already running. So this was not a mistake. This was one after another. He had his social media accounts, the YouTube videos, his Facebook account, his Twitter account, also started pulling out the word that he was indeed a candidate for president. I guess when you stop and think about it, probably strategically makes sense because helps him dominate a couple news cycles instead of just one. I mean, you're not going to see, I'm counted, in the neighborhood of a couple dozen TV trucks that are lined up here outside of the Expo Center. A lot of national media have been planning this trip for a while. They're not going to turn around and cancel their plans just because he sent out a tweet this morning. So he gets the stories in the evening news, maybe in tomorrow morning's news, and people have been talking about him all day, too.
Now, this announcement comes less than 24 hours after he signed the state budget into law. He had been saying he was going to do the budget, then the other, the presidential announcement. Are they close enough together that maybe the budget steps on his announcement a little?
I don't think the budget steps on his announcement, no. I think most people, I think it'd be the other way around. You know, there's a lot of important stuff in the budget, stuff that was added to the budget in the remaining week or so before it was signed. You know, if anything, nobody's talking about that now. People are talking about him running for president. And so, you know, this is a pretty big media spectacle as it is whenever one of the bigger names gets into a presidential race. So I think, it's definitely going the other way.
We'll dig into the governor's vetoes in that budget in just a minute. But first, for what we've seen in this video, what we've been hearing from the governor leading up to today's announcement, can we say what kind of image Governor Walker's portraying as a presidential candidate?
Yeah, he wants people pretty plain. He wants people to remember what put him on this national stage to begin with. I mean, we're speaking outside of the Waukesha County Expo Center. That's where he held his recall night victory party a few years ago. I think you can expect him to talk about that plenty during his speech here tonight. His basic message in that YouTube video that he put out was, look, you have some candidates who've never picked a fight and they just win elections. You've got some candidates who pick lots of fights, but they haven't really accomplished anything. His message is, we've done both. That we've got this blue state here. He's won 3 times, and I expect to hear that over and over and over again. Of course, this is going to be a different electorate here in 2016 than in the other races that the governor's run. Assuming that the governor would make it that far next year, presidential year turnout is a lot different in Wisconsin than gubernatorial or even recall turnout, but that's going to be the message you hear from the governor over and over again, is that he's won 3 elections in 4 years. He took on a big fight, in his words. and that if he could do it here, he can do it elsewhere.
Talking to WPR reporter Sean Johnson about all the news surrounding Governor Walker this last couple of days. Today's campaign announcement, presidential campaign announcement. Big news yesterday, though, Governor Walker signed the budget, 104 uses of the extensive veto powers that the Wisconsin governor gets. Sean, first of all, is that a lot as these budgets go?
I think it's a lot for him. I think he's been more on the same page with legislators in previous budgets since, you know, he's had Republican legislatures to work with ever since he won in 2010. He's, you know, he's never had to deal with a Democratic legislature's budget where you'd see a lot more vetoes likely. So maybe a lot for him, but I think on the whole, the substance of the budget doesn't change a whole lot based on the vetoes. I think it's very similar to the budget that he introduced earlier this year. And while, you know, the national media and Wisconsin media may be focused on the presidential campaign here, I think it's probably that budget that's going to go a long way toward deciding, you know, what happens in Wisconsin state government in the 2016 elections, in the state legislature, especially, you know, in the Senate, which is pretty closely contested.
Now, in his statement that came out after the signing of the budget, he said taxpayers come first in this budget. What was he pointing to there?
Yeah, that's the message that he's had throughout this entire budget process. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there that Republicans admittedly didn't like. I mean, 11 Assembly Republicans did not vote for this budget. That is a high number. They have a big majority over there. They can afford to have 11 of their more vulnerable members vote no on a budget. You know, that's a message that they can take to voters next year and say, look, I was independent here. I voted against this. They can attach whatever reason they want to, really. You know, this is, sorry, Rob, I've been yammering so long here outside.
That's okay.
What was your question?
Well, Sean, I want to key in on a couple of specifics of the vetoes. The payday lender section.
Go.
This was a late add, right, in that $9.99, the last-minute budget document that Joint Finance passed. What did he cut there?
Yeah, this was, as you mentioned, this was attached at the very last minute in the budget committee process. No public hearing. Nobody ever said this is why this would be a good idea. When it got brought up on the assembly floor, you know, Democrats brought up an amendment to try to take it out. Nobody on the Republican side stood up and said, well, this is why this would be a good idea. It was one of those that got added. And the governor said that, you know, they would actually give payday lenders, I guess, the rights that other financial institutions did not have. I think you also have to look at this through the lens of, you know, he's trying to win votes of social conservatives in Iowa. A lot of church groups don't care for payday lenders at all. And so expanding them in this budget, maybe not a lot of upside there for the governor, and maybe an easy call for him to make as far as vetoes go.
Now, how about a Democratic response to the budget signing? They're looking at this presidential announcement as well in this context. What have Democrats had to say?
They are focused on essentially the budget as it was introduced earlier this year. And you know, the foundation of it, as far as they're concerned, is that it kind of leaves schools hanging, that it effectively cuts schools in the first year of the budget, because while Republicans in the legislature restored funding for K through 12 public schools, they also approved a big expansion of the private school voucher program, and they changed the way that private school voucher schools, or private voucher schools, will be funded in the future. So those schools are going to be kind of slowly siphoning away money that used to flow to public schools. They're also keyed in on the big cut to the University of Wisconsin system. This is the third budget that the governor's had, third budget when UW's seen a cut. This one is sizable, $250 million, at a time when the country and even Wisconsin is going through a period of economic growth. So you would expect this would be a time when the state would be able to spend more on stuff like higher ed, and then the governor's budget, Wisconsin spending less. That's something that the Democrats have focused on from day one. And while Republican legislators did reduce that cut slightly, It's still a big cut to the UW.
We're going to hear more about the K-12 portion of the budget after 4:30 today. Sean, before we let you go for now, you're at the Waukesha Expo Center, as you mentioned. What's the scene there so far as far as people lining up? I heard there's supposed to be protests. So what are you seeing from where you are?
Yeah, very long line of people waiting to get in the building right now, and they are lined up in the July heat along the asphalt. So not a lot of energy in the crowd waiting to get in the building right now. I mean, it feels a lot warmer than the thermometer says right now. Inside, pretty elaborate stage. It looks like the governor's going to speak from the center of the building. There's media set up, national media set up on stages all over the place, local media stuck here and there. Outside, as I mentioned, a couple dozen or more TV trucks. It looks like they might be setting up for a barbecue after the event. So it looks like they're starting to file into the Expo Center now, and it should be filling up pretty soon.
All right, Sean, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you in a little while.
You're welcome, Ron.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol Reporter, with us to talk about Governor Walker signing the state budget bill and his bid for the presidency. Sean's back with us after 5, live from the Waukesha Expo Center, where he's covering the governor's campaign kickoff.
Gemma Tarlak joins us for a look at some of the most compelling stories from the world of science, including the past and present of climate change in Mongolia, where a changing climate may have sparked Genghis Khan's rise to power, and where modern-day changes are endangering a way of life.
Gemma Tarlak is Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about some of the coolest science news. Gemma, welcome back.
Hi, always great to be with you. I missed you.
Well, you too. Well, now let's go to Mongolia, Gemma. Let's
okay.
buy some plane tickets. Oh, no, wait. So this article, climate change may have driven Genghis Khan's rise to power, close to 1,000 years ago. How are these tied together?
Well, it's really interesting, and I love the way the geographer we profile in the story puts it. She says, nature set the table, and Genghis Khan came to eat. And basically, just as Genghis Khan was developing some political ambitions, that seems to be the theme today, it turns out that the weather really could not have been better. The climate actually could not have been better. It was mild. It was damp. There was a lot of grass growing. It was the perfect, perfect climate to raise a whole bunch of horses for the Mongol horde to ride all through Europe and Asia. So he really benefited from this, you know, very particular, unusual pattern, climate pattern, just that coincided just with the start of his rise. And they figured this out by looking at tree rings from trees that were growing during that era. And meanwhile, you know, these dendrochronologists are spending a lot of time in Mongolia, and they're, you know, experiencing the current Mongolian climate, the current culture there, and they realized that there is another cultural climate link that's not positive. I mean, it was great for Genghis Khan 800 years ago. You know, he rode all the way to success. But right now what's happening is we're entering a much hotter, drier climate period. And that, in addition to several man-made factors, is basically, it is really wrecking Mongolia. And it's tragic. It's a tragedy unfolding right in front of us.
I want to go back and talk a little bit more about those tree rings. You said that's how researchers figured out that the climate was so hospitable for Genghis Khan and his horde. So how do the tree rings give us that information about what the climate was like?
Well, what they do is they look at trees that are alive now, and they find the tree ring patterns from, they're able to, you know, count back the number of years, because a ring grows in every year, and then they basically build up overlapping trees. So you find a tree that was alive from 1960 until now, and then you find a tree that was alive, say, from 1920 until 1980, and you look at that overlap of tree rings, and that's how you build this chronology further and further back in time. And so they found trees that were actually alive in the 11th and 12th and 13th centuries, and they were able to determine by the thickness and the composition of the rings what kind of climate it was. If it's a really mild, wet climate, that tree ring is going to be nice and fat and healthy. If it was a really lousy, dry climate, the tree ring is going to be, not so good, not so healthy. So they can actually determine climate by just looking at the tree rings.
Now, fast forwarding back to modern times, in this piece, I guess Mongolia among the places in the world most affected by a warming climate.
Yes, it is. We're seeing already their temperature has increased more than 2 degrees Celsius, and the global average worldwide is just under 1 degree, I think. So it's even more than double the increase we've seen globally. And basically, in addition to a hotter, drier climate, it unfortunately coincided with some economic and cultural changes. People switched over their livestock from sheep to goats, and because it's, you know, you can make a lot more money selling the goat hair or pelts. I'm sorry, I'm not a Mongolian herder. I don't know what it's called, but you can make a lot more money with goats than you can with sheep. And so they switched over to goats. But the problem is, you know, the sheep kind of nibble at the grass. The goats just tear it up and leave nothing. So in addition to this hotter, drier climate as a result of global climate change issues, they're also desertifying their land by having their goats graze it all the way down to just dirt.
And you said that climate change is hitting Mongolia especially hard. Why is it that Mongolia is a flashpoint for climate change?
Well, it's a number of reasons. It's in a continental climate. You know, it's kind of right smack in the middle of Asia, and so it doesn't have mitigating factors like a lot of the maritime countries do. And there are a number of issues, but it's really just kind of, unfortunately, it's a perfect storm of conditions that is really wrecking it.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine about some of the most compelling stories from the world of science. And Gemma, a brighter note, a special section in Discover on powering the future, looking at some of the different ways people are addressing climate change, carbon emissions. One of the things you look at is stellar energy, solar panels, right? We know what those are, but in space, in Earth's orbit. Tell us how that works.
Yes, space-based solar power. And as you mentioned, it's part of our special section on energy. So if you read the Mongolia story and you get really down, don't worry. We have a lot of really good news about the climate and about energy in the magazine as well. Basically, there are these huge arrays, and there are a few different designs. One of them looks like a giant tulip or a giant bell shape. And they put the photovoltaic panels up in space. And, of course, you get, you know, 35 to 70% more intense sun rays than you would on the ground. And the sun shines on those panels without worrying about clouds or smog or anything. The panels actually convert it to energy, which is then beamed to Earth. So, and the panels, I should also add, they can be in a geosynchronous orbit, which means it's always sunny where the panels are. So it's actually, they think, like the same size array in space would get 40 times more energy than it would on Earth. So it's a huge, huge energy, resource.
Without getting too technical, how do you beam energy back to Earth?
Very carefully. No, but seriously, you know, there are some safety concerns, and in the designs they have, and they've been thinking about this since the 1960s, quite frankly, but in the designs they have, they look at either microwave beams or a particular kind of infrared laser beam, and they have all kinds of safeguards so that it would beam down to a power station and, you know, it would shut off automatically if the beam started going wayward or such. So there are some safety concerns, but they're working those out. And the great thing is there are no environmental concerns. It's a limitless source of energy.
How close are we to actually having this happen as launching things into space gets a little cheaper all the time?
Well, unfortunately, we're not as close as I wish we were, because the big issue here is indeed the cost. And, you know, companies like SpaceX are all about lowering the cost, but that's not going to happen until they figure out how to get reusable rockets that are basically rockets as reusable as airplanes, because they're estimating it would take more than 10,000 tons of equipment to build one of these space-based solar power stations. And when you think about it, it costs, I think in our article we see something like $4,600 for every 2 pounds that they send it to space now just to launch it. When you're talking about 10,000 tons, I mean, you can't even fathom the cost. No pun intended, the costs are astronomical. But they're hoping as soon as that cost of getting stuff into space is lowered, the whole thing can be built by robots and operational with minimal maintenance for decades. So we're getting closer, but we're not there.
All right. Well, one thing that sounds like we're a little bit closer to way back here on planet Earth is the city of Portland putting turbines into their sewer system. Now, what's going on there? How does that work?
Yeah, I love this. It's such a simple, elegant solution. What they've done is installed these special turbines into the water and sewage pipes in some areas where they're revamping the pipes. And basically, the water, you know, it comes down the hill, it goes through and actually drives the turbine, which creates power. And right now in Portland, they're able to power about 150 homes just with what's going through the pipes and what would be going through the pipes anyway. So it's like this free source of energy that they're using. I love it. It's such a great little project.
All right, Gemma, thank you so much, as always, for joining us today.
My pleasure. Have fun.
That was Gemma Tarlak. She's senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us every month here on Central Time to look at some of the most interesting stories from the world of science and technology.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Just over 20 years ago, a new movement aimed to change the way teens think about sex and to get them to hold off on sex until marriage. Often tied to evangelical Christianity, organizations like True Love Waits and the Silver Ring Thing brought their message to tens of thousands of teens in their first years, millions since then.
Well, those and other purity movements don't have as much attention in popular culture now as they did then. There are still active parts of American society. The Silver Ring Thing tours the nation with a live show with a stop in Wisconsin last year and has events scheduled for this fall and around the country. And True Love Waits is still encouraging teens to sign purity pledges.
Our next guest traces the origins of the modern purity movement and says it has deeper roots than we might think. Sarah Mosliner joins us now. She's assistant professor of religion at Central Michigan University. Her new book is Virgin Nation, Sexual Purity and American Adolescence. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how influential have these modern purity movements been since they started back in the 90s?
Very much so. And we could even go back further and talk about the 1980s. And this is really when people started thinking about wanting funding for abstinence-only education. That started in 1981. So we can go back even further, just looking at the contemporary context. And since then, as I show in my book, there has been an increased, not only public, but also political attention to sexual abstinence. When I was in high school myself, even as an evangelical, the concept of sexual purity wasn't something we talked about, but now everyone knows what it means. And most of the students I currently teach, even at a large public institution, get some form of this in their sex education. So even people who are not part of the evangelical subculture have been deeply impacted by the purity movement.
And that's part of the big shift that groups like True Love Waits and the Silver Ring Thing, you focus on them in your book. They took this to from what might have been a private conversation in a family or maybe in a church to a public conversation in schools and people making these public statements, these public pledges for everyone else to know about.
Absolutely. That's absolutely right. And I try and be careful about not critiquing people who do have these private conversations and make these commitments within the privacy of their relationships, of their family life, of their premarital life. What I'm more concerned with is the movement, a movement which says our way of being in the world is essential to the thriving of the United States. And that's when we all need to start paying attention, because they're not just saying, hey, if you're a Christian and you believe this way, we want to support you. It's going further to say this has implications for our entire nation state.
Well, let's dig into what happens, what these groups do. Let's start with True Love Waits. Mm-hmm. Give us a little more detail about what they've done since the 90s and the pledges that they have focused on.
Of course. So one of the earliest things they did made it evident that they weren't just interested in keeping this a local kind of small town local church event. One of the first things they did was at an event on the National Mall in 1993. They pounded into the ground about 20,000 pledge cards. As a form of a national display to show to everyone in the nation's capital, look, here are thousands of young people who have made this pledge to sexual purity, to remaining pure until marriage, and we are making a political statement by doing that. We are political actors, and that was a significant move and a way to draw in other people beyond the Southern Baptist context. So unlike other groups, Silver Ring Thing is not focused on a particular show that they may tour around the country. They have materials that they make available to churches, so local churches will purchase the materials, schools will purchase the materials, and put on their own events. There is, of course, a roster of speakers that you can bring in to any event that you have, either at your school or at your church, who will talk about it. And so, of course, people know who this network is that they can draw on to bring in into any kind of True Love Waits event. So they provide the materials, but then local organizations will put on the events themselves.
And then that's True Love Waits. The Silver Ring Thing, as you mentioned, it's a show. It tours pretty lively and sounds like drawing a lot from the state-of-the-art media of the day.
Exactly. I think it was Sean Cole from Massachusetts Public Radio who called it part rave, part Saturday Night Live, part Saturday Night Revival. And that's exactly what it is. It is very attention-getting. It is carefully planned to attract the adolescent imagination. And one of the things I noticed is, you know, for the first 40 minutes, you see more references to someone like Will Ferrell than you do Jesus Christ. And so there's really an attempt to attract people who have not been part of a church, been part of the evangelical subculture, and that's done very intentionally.
Talking to Sarah Mosliner from Central Michigan University, her new book is Virgin Nation, Sexual Purity and American Adolescence, looking at purity movements, groups like True Love Waits and others calling for purity pledges, virginity pledges. And Sarah, you alluded to this earlier. You're concerned that this isn't just a personal message about personal behavior. A lot is riding on this for these groups, saying that the fate of the nation in many ways hangs on this. How is that? How do they make that connection?
Right. So this is something that came out in bits and pieces in my initial research into the contemporary movement. I kept hearing things about the decline of civilizations and bringing revival to America. And so there was this connection they were making between people taking sexual purity pledges and the thriving of the nation state. And I wanted to see where that came from. And I actually went back through the 20th century and found other times when evangelicals, fundamentalists, even more progressive evangelicals of the 19th century, first wave feminists, in fact, who used this same construction to assert the importance of sexual purity. And so that's something I found consistent. And something that isn't as evident in today's purity movement. So if you go to the events that it sounds like they're coming to Wisconsin, you won't necessarily see much of this rhetoric, but it's very much underneath the surface, this belief that this is something that isn't just about what's good for the individual. It's about protecting the nation state, because if people are getting into marriages not being sexually pure, those marriages are going to be faulty, and if the marriages are faulty, the children from those marriages will be delinquent, and on until you have a crumbling social structure. And this is something that has been used since the 19th century in response to fears about the decline of Anglo-Saxon civilization. It was used in the 1950s by people who feared the communists. It was a way of for Americans to protect themselves against communist incursion. And it was a way in the 1970s for people to protect themselves against what they believed were the excesses of the sexual revolution. And so you see that in all of these different places historically.
And you write that other scholars have seen these purity movements as a reaction to that last thing you mentioned, the sexual revolution of the 60s into the 70s. You say this is a tradition that goes back, and there's partly that's true, but it goes back way further than that.
Exactly. And so if I were to do, if I were to have written this book just starting with the rise of the religious right, I would have seen the use of therapeutic rhetoric, the emphasis on the individual, using popular media, all of these things that are really hallmarks of contemporary late 20th century religion. But as I said, that, and that's what I had seen for the most part, but when I started seeing this other current about national decline, that really raised some question marks, and I knew I had to go further back. Because nowadays, people don't respond a lot to the fire and brimstone theology. They want to hear theologies of self-care. This is what we call the therapeutic, that God is taking care of you, God wants the best of you. And that's primarily what you will hear if you go to these events. But just underneath that is this more long-term theology that connects these ideas to the well-being of the nation state and to these fears that the United States is going to be rendered somehow less powerful based on the individual choices people make with their sexuality.
We're talking to Sarah Mosliner about purity movements and virginity pledges in the United States. Her new book is Virgin Nation, Sexual Purity and American Adolescence.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these purity movements? Are they sending a positive message to young people, or do you see a downside? Have you participated in one of these purity movements as an organizer, maybe even taken a pledge yourself? Call 800-642-1234. We continue our conversation about sexual purity movements here in the United States. Sarah Mosliner is our guest. She's an assistant professor of religion at Central Michigan University, and her new book is called Virgin Nation, Sexual Purity and American Adolescence.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. What do you think of this idea of teens taking virginity pledges? Have you been involved with one of the movements our guest is talking about, groups like True Love Waits or the Silver Ring thing? What impact did that have on your life? Call 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Jan on the line in Duluth, Minnesota. Jan, hi.
Hi. I'm 70 years old, so I'm a real old-timer. Back when I was, say, eighth grade, so it had been like 1958, we, too, knew better than to have sex. But what we had was like a golden bracelet that had the Teen Commandments on it. And I couldn't afford it, but some kids could. And it had things like stop and think before you drink. They were just short little things that would be a commandment for a teen. But I think that's, I don't know, that just kind of is strange to me to call it purity. I never considered myself pure, and I don't know, the meek shall inherit the earth.
All right, Jan, thank you so much for that call. So the Teen Commandments in that Cold War era you were talking about, Sarah, but was it thought of in terms of purity then in the 50s as it is now in these contemporary movements?
Yeah, it's really, that's a really fascinating to hear. I know in the 19th century, young people would often wear silver crowns or shields as a sign if they have, and when they did take pledges. I hadn't heard about these bracelets, which is really fascinating. Yeah, the concept of purity is really interesting because it's on the one hand, it's very specific, but it's also very broad. It can mean so many different things. And it hasn't, in the concept itself hasn't been used throughout the 20th century in the way it has in the late 19th century and in the late 20th century, which I, as a historian, I found very fascinating. What is interesting is that when these groups started in the early 90s, they were using the concept of abstinence, of sexual abstinence, which many people understood to mean sexual intercourse. And so what they discovered is that people found many loopholes and so were able to get around that, and so decided to use the concept of purity to provide a more holistic understanding of what they really meant. So it's interesting that they had to kind of change their language a little bit. And then, of course, purity does give that sense of holiness, of being set apart in some way. I mean, purity codes are something we see in ancient cultures as a way of setting groups apart from one another. And that's very much, I think, what this movement is trying to make use of.
Jan, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Cheryl in Eau Claire. Cheryl, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. I tuned in just a few moments ago. I was wondering if your guest's scholarship has extended to investigating really how effective this movement has been in delaying first sexual experience for participating adolescents, young adults.
Cheryl, thanks a lot for that call. And Sarah, that's been a controversy over this organization since the 90s.
Absolutely. And there has been significant research done in the 90s and into the 2000s on just that question. And in fact, most of the scholarship has been around that particular question. And that is certainly stuff that I cover. My question had more to do with the rhetoric that was being used to promote the ideals. And what I did discover, though, is that when religious groups are using scripture or theology or whatever to make their claims, what they're doing is saying it doesn't matter what the science says. We're doing what we're doing because this is what God tells us to do. And so at some point in my research, you know, I was trying to sort through all the debates about the scholarship, about whether it works or doesn't work, and what it even means to say that something works. The very first study said, okay, people who take purity pledges tend to start having sex 2 years later. Okay, well, that delays first intercourse, but it doesn't necessarily keep them from having sex outside of marriage. So is that working? Is that not working? It really depends on who's doing the analysis of that data. But for these groups themselves, what the data says doesn't really matter to them. They're going to keep doing what they're doing because they believe it's been commanded by God.
Talking to Sarah Mosliner. Her new book is Virgin Nation, looking at the purity movement in the modern United States and its origins. I want to get into gender messages here, Sarah, mm-hmm. before we run out of time. What are girls and boys hearing about who they are as girls and boys from these movements?
Yes, yeah, certainly. Sexual purity, the concept of it really functions on the basis of traditional gender roles. And by traditional gender roles, I mean roles that were established in the 19th century on the basis of the Victorian family. And what's happened with the religious right is that they have made those gender roles seem like they are biblically based, when in fact they're not. We know marriage and family in the Bible, depending on what part of the Bible you're reading, was very, very different from modern family life. But the claim is these are biblical roles, that men and women have complementary roles to play, and they need to prepare for those roles. And sexual purity, making this commitment, is something that helps you prepare for that role. And it's certainly something that that they make use of. They know the romantic narratives or rather they assume the romantic narratives are going to draw young women to them. And so in some cases they have to work harder to draw young men to them. One organization stopped using the word purity because it was people felt alienated. The young men felt alienated because it was too girly, and so they're working within these gendered stereotypes in order to get their message across about reifying those same gender roles and saying that, you know, if you follow these things, this is your, you know, this is your prescription for happiness. And we will show you how to do that. And certainly in terms of sexual desire, that is very much a gendered norm as well, in terms of girls not having sexual desire and boys having sexual desire. And so it kind of naturalizes these gendered relationships that are deeply problematic.
As we wrap up, you've been following these issues, these movements, for some years now. Mm-hmm. Here in 2015, how do you see them changing, shifting at all, if at all, as we look ahead?
Sure. Well, it's certainly changed. I mean, things really reached their peak during the Bush administration because of the funding that was made available. Obama did things a little differently, and really that's kind of the shift that I look for, is who's going to be the next person who is making funding available and who is it being made available to. And certainly Republicans tend to very much favor abstinence-only education. Democrats favor a comprehensive education. And you can tell, depending on who is in the White House, what is sort of being given the most attention and funding. Otherwise, it's interesting, especially with the recent ruling on gay marriage. People have been asking me if, you know, GLBT people might, you know, jump on to this purity movement, which I don't think will happen, but that certainly adds a new layer of analysis for people who are in the business of protecting what they believe to be biblical marriage.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Sarah Mosliner, assistant professor of religion at Central Michigan University. We've been talking about her new book, Virgin Nation, Sexual Purity and American Adolescence.
Here's a question to chew on. What's the signature food of Wisconsin? The Cooking Channel asked its viewers to pick a distinctive food for every state in the union. We've got a map with the answers, by the way, via Mental Floss over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Our neighbors in Michigan got the pasty. I think of that as an Upper Peninsula thing more than a statewide dish, but okay. Minnesota got hot dish. I think they say hot dish or something over like that over there, as I understand it. Illinois got deep dish pizza. I get that. Chicago. Iowa, fair enough, grilled sweet corn on the cob.
And here in Wisconsin, the winner is bratwurst stewed in sauerkraut.
All right, a brat makes sense. You were making the case for the cheese curd earlier, Veronica.
I have to say cheese curd. We are, after all, the dairy state.
Uh-huh.
And where else can you find squeaky cheese curds?
Or the deep fried ones.
And the deep fried ones, even better. Yeah.
Wendy on Facebook said, hey, frozen custard, Joe says, with the brats. Yeah, close enough. You can keep sharing your thoughts at the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.